Meeting of the Legislative Energy Commission will come to order, and we have a couple of big items on the agenda, but we're going to start. Senator Representative Hortman moves the approval of the minutes from the January 8th meeting. Do we have a quorum present?
Not yet.
Okay, we'll take the minutes later. And several of the members of the commission went to a Minnesota Energy Efficiency Association conference back in, I think it was December.
January.
And Senator Senjum, did you want to give any comments on things that from that conference?
Yeah, like a true Republican, I rode the L train. It's in Chicago, by the way. And you taught me that, Senator Marty. Yeah, it was a Midwest Energy Solutions Conference, January 14th to 16th in Chicago. The primary emphasis on it is all about energy. It was again, a couple of days. I kind of went back to the book. I noted that this group's anticipating a growth in energy efficiency from the standpoint of cash in the neighborhood of nearly $2 billion in the next couple of years. And they're a group that obviously supports energy efficiency and moving in that direction. And so that is kind of the purpose. They, amongst other things, had an award ceremony for people and organizations that did, you know, that have shown leadership in that area. It's an organization that is largely composed of, I would say, maybe the business end of energy. We were, you know, we involved in government. I mean, there were certainly some there, but it was a lot about, again, efficiency. I didn't sense as much about governmental policy, of course, weaved into all their efficiency discussions was some discussion about policy or in fact policy was driving it. But I thought overall it was interesting, a nice array of exhibits and things like that, so that you can partake of that kind of information. But all in all, I thought informative and worth a couple of days.
Good. Thank you. And Senator Dibble, you were also at that. It was that Energy Efficiency Conference. Did you have any other quick comments about?
It was a great meeting. A lot of folks from all sectors, privates, utilities, advocates, government. A number of other legislators were there from other states, so that was great. A lot of the topics covered actually were hit right on some of the presentations that we've had, so it was an ability to an opportunity to really drill down in some detail on some of the subjects that had been advanced as good ideas or ideas to consider, at least in this setting. I thought what I would do is I'd just quickly touch on some of these, and some of these actually I think we're going to see in bill form coming up in the coming session. I know for a fact a few of them are going to be presented as bills, given that I'll be the chief author of a couple of these ideas. So there were a discussion about getting to beyond the 1% savings, even going so bold as talking about getting to a 2% savings in energy. How is that achievable in a way that, of course, works for all stakeholders in a cost-efficient manner? A lot of fairly high-level, detailed technical workshops on things like innovating in residential efficiency programming. Some of that was a little bit above my pay grade, a little more detailed, is more for folks who are implementing, designing and implementing these sorts of programs. But I did drop in on a few of them just to get a sense of what the specific challenges that utilities and contractors and program designers struggle with. What was really interesting was to listen to the presentation on how industries can successfully participate in efficiency. So there were some really interesting discussions about program design, but what was the most interesting was hearing from the young man who's an engineer who works for a company, and he's tapped ways to save energy at the factories all over the country, and he really knew his stuff, and it was really interesting to hear about kind of the struggles. And he's really on the bubble, so he struggles with these factory managers because he's got energy savings requirements, and these factory managers do too, but they have, they've been running these factories in a certain way for a long, long time, and he's really able to go out and demonstrate, you know, with the addition of some fairly cost-effective technology to take advantage of the energy that they're generating inside those factories already. He was really interesting. We heard from our own city of Minneapolis, Brendan Slaughterback, and how urban locations, cities, and municipalities can work with communities, industries, residential areas on energy efficiency savings, how we evaluate energy efficiency programs. The Department of Energy is developing some uniform methods so that we can do apples to apples across states, across utilities, and the like, so that we really understand how to compare and contrast across different geographic bases, the cost effectiveness. Energy codes, again, something that Minnesota really excels in with the research we're doing at the University of Minnesota in conjunction with our Department of Energy Resources at Commerce. They didn't present on that, but there was a lot of talk about how the codes can really drive energy efficiency, particularly new construction, but also for substantial rehab. Incentivizing utilities on bill, on statement billing, decoupling. Again, we've heard a lot about that here as well. Technology adoption and lighting programs kind of rounded out the meeting. You know, and that's always interesting. What are the emerging technologies, products, services, lighting techniques? But a big emphasis there was it's not just about applying the technologies, but it's about managing buildings' operations. It's not enough to put in the great light bulbs. You got to turn them off at night. Or, you know, of course, taking advantage of daylighting and variable lighting and that sort of thing. So I'll stop talking there. It was really interesting. I enjoyed myself.
Thank you. Any questions? If not, Senator Hortman had moved the meeting minutes of the January 8th meeting. Representative Hortman, I apologize. You know, a quorum is now present, and Senator Tomasoni is also present on the phone, I believe. Is there any discussion on the approval of the minutes? Not all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Now we'd like to hear on the propane shortage issue. We have Bill Grant from the Department of Commerce who is going to present on update us on the status and what's happening.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the commission. Happy to provide an update for you on the propane crisis that we've been dealing with for the last.
Can you pull the microphone as close to you as you can get it? Thanks.
Certainly. Commissioner Rothman sends his apologies for missing today's hearing. He is actually in Washington today testifying before Senator Franken's Energy Committee on the energy programs that we've been so successful with in Minnesota and also the propane crisis. I don't think I have to tell all of you that the propane shortage and high prices have affected Minnesota families, businesses, and farms across the state. Over 250,000 households, businesses, and farms rely on propane and heating to heat their homes and businesses during the winter. Most of the propane uses in greater Minnesota, where connection to natural gas lines is generally not available. This year, Minnesota's coldest on record winter in 30 years also saw a propane market where prices spiked and supply was low. Shortage caused a spike in in prices nearly four times its normal rate. At one point, the department received a quote that an energy assistance client had received of $6.67 a gallon. Compare that to the October price of $1.67 a gallon, you can begin to get a sense for the dimensions of the problem. The stress and anxiety for consumers who are unable to receive timely deliveries of propane due to this shortage, as well as questions about how to pay bills, were the concerns heard by the department and the administration. So I want to give you a little bit of a briefing on what we think happened and actions that the administration has taken to try and resolve the situation. First, what are the kind of short and long-term factors that brought this about? Families, farmers, and small businesses have witnessed firsthand the dramatic rise in propane costs, and they look directly at their bill and wonder whether the prices are fair and whether the propane industry is simply making money off the cold temperatures and their misfortune. The industry lists the following as contributing factors to the shortage in skyrocketing prices. First of all, we had a very late planting season that produced a later than normal harvest. Then the fall weather was wet and cold, and that required more propane to dry the crop. That was then compounded by the cold weather dipping farther south in the Midwest than normal, and therefore a greater use of propane and a depletion of reserves across the region. Shortly thereafter, Kinder Morgan, the pipeline company, closed the Cochin pipeline for 3 weeks right between Thanksgiving and Christmas for upgrades that also impacted the level of supply that we were experiencing here in Minnesota. Our extremely cold winter in Minnesota and across the country placed greater stress on supply that we really haven't, that hadn't been recovered from the fall grain drying season. In sum, the lack of supply with greater than normal demand resulted in prices that spiked very high, as I pointed out. So what is the industry, what is the administration and the industry's response to this crisis? First, on behalf of the administration, throughout the crisis, Governor Dayton has exercised his executive powers to relieve the shortage, increase the supply of propane and heating fuels for the state of Minnesota and our region, provide greater financial assistance for families that are put in a difficult situation by these higher prices, and put the emergency infrastructure in place to do everything possible to keep Minnesotans safe. As the lead agency, I can say that on behalf of the administration, we took this situation extremely seriously. You have all the comprehensive lists in front of you of the actions taken by Governor Dayton that should have been in a handout to you. I will discuss some of the key actions taken to provide relief to Minnesotans. Earlier this fall, Governor Dayton convened a meeting with propane industry and various stakeholders, railroads, the farming community, legislators, to discuss the propane needs of Minnesota and how to address the transport and infrastructure needs associated with the closing of the Cochin pipeline later this year. Governor Dayton issued the first executive order for an hour of service waiver to allow truckers and transporters the ability to work longer hours and get the propane to customers during the fall harvest. Early in January, as the polar vortex descended on the country, actions were taken to help intervene to move product north. The hour of service waivers in Minnesota were extended by the governor as needed. The U.S. Department of Transportation established a regional emergency declaration suspending the regulatory provisions pertaining to hours of service for drivers of commercial motor vehicles transporting propane to affected Midwestern states. And the American Railroad Association asked its 175 members to prioritize propane delivery by making cars available and dropping propane shipments at necessary locations. On Thursday, January 23rd, multiple governors, including Governor Dayton, reached out to Texas Governor Rick Perry, asking him to waive trucking restrictions that prohibit out-of-state trucks to export propane out of Texas. Governor Perry granted a 14-day waiver. That same day, the Department of Commerce initiated the necessary steps to increase the low-income home energy assistance program crisis benefits from $500 to $1,000 for applicants heating their homes with propane and heating oil. This was a key step, we feel, to increase these benefits to alleviate also any minimum fill requirements that may have been required by propane dealers. Beginning on Saturday, January 25th, communication from the state to the federal government, from the governor and our federal partners began. The governor and Minnesota's congressional leader sent a letter to President Obama urging him to knock down regulatory barriers and take the necessary steps to alleviate the shortage and to provide expanded relief to families and agricultural producers. On Monday, January 27th, Governor Dayton issued a peacetime state of emergency in Minnesota in response to the severe shortage of propane and other home heating fuel supply statewide. By declaring a state of emergency, this step was needed by the administration to initiate the State Emergency Operations Center and the coordination between the Department of Public Safety, Homeland Security Emergency Management, and their county emergency management partners, and the Commerce Department. Putting the state emergency in place set the foundation to move quickly if the situation would have escalated more rapidly. For example, if large numbers of Minnesotans had needed shelter because they would have been forced to leave their homes. At the time of the state of emergency, the governor also authorized Commissioner Rothman to fully investigate consumer complaints related to price gouging, price fixing, or any false market disruptions. On Tuesday, the 28th, Governor Dayton convened a second meeting with the propane industry, Commissioner Fredrickson, Commissioner Rothman, and several legislators to discuss action steps that can be taken to provide relief to Minnesotans. The governor asked industry directly to provide examples where obstacles were in place and what actions he could take to remove them. Once identified, the administration worked very quickly to act on each and every one of those suggestions. To address the volume of complaints and requests for energy assistance, the State Emergency Operations Center, the 1-800 line, was open to provide a one-stop shop for Minnesotans with questions or complaints related to propane. And that Emergency Operations Center is still open today and will be at least through this weekend. At the end of the day, Tuesday, yesterday, the call center had handled over 3,000 calls from Minnesotans. Types of calls broke down roughly 50-50 between those seeking financial assistance and those wanting to complain about the high prices. We triaged a number of emergency calls that were prioritized and personally resolved by Commerce staff and the local service agencies that deliver the energy assistance program statewide. 39 emergency calls were received where consumers had run out of propane, and Commerce staff triaged those calls and notified the appropriate authorities to remedy the situation. In some cases, that involved working with propane dealers to get emergency fills. In other cases, that involved some sheltering for those individuals. 25 emergency calls were also received where the caller didn't qualify for energy assistance, and they were referred directly to the industry association for help. On January 31st, Governor Dayton contacted the CEOs of two different propane pipeline companies, the Williams Company and Enterprise, to discuss the Midwest propane shortage and strategies to increase the supply of heating fuels to provide additional supplies to Minnesotans. The following Tuesday, the 4th, Governor Dayton and six other Midwestern governors sent a letter to President Obama, as I mentioned before, asking for assistance of the federal government to increase propane supply by every means of transport. This communication to the federal government laid the foundation for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to invoke its emergency power for the first time in its history. On the same day, Governor Dayton announced that we would be increasing the availability of low-income energy assistance funds by increasing the eligibility threshold from 50% of the state median income to 60%, the maximum allowed by the federal government, providing energy assistance eligibility to an additional 120,000 households. In conjunction with greater eligibility for LIHEAP, Governor Dayton sent a letter to Minnesota state legislators notifying them that if the federal government does not provide additional LIHEAP support for Minnesota, he plans to include a $17 million request in his supplemental budget for that purpose. The following day, on Wednesday the 5th, Governor Dayton sent a letter to President Obama urging the administration to provide additional LIHEAP funding to help with the expected shortfall that we're anticipating yet this year. Without additional funds, it looks like the program will run out of money mid-March. On Wednesday the 5th, in response to Governor Dayton and the Midwest Governor Association's request, Texas Governor Perry extended his proclamation waiving trucking restrictions for an additional 14 days. On Thursday the 6th, Governor Dayton issued an executive order extending again the hour of service waiver. And on Friday the 7th, FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, as I said, for the first time invoked its authority under the Interstate Commerce Act to help alleviate a shortage of propane supplies to consumers in the Midwest and Northeast. As I said, this is the first time that FERC has exercised that authority, and in this case, it ordered pipelines to prioritize the shipment of propane. Enterprise Pipelines, in response, said it would inject an additional 150,000 barrels into its pipeline yesterday and plans to inject another 350,000 barrels tomorrow, Thursday. Of course, I can't speak for the industry, but the action steps taken by the industry that were requested by the administration were generally to remove existing barriers to move more supply to Kansas and Minnesota, specifically for hours of service waivers at the state level, which Governor Dayton has issued and reissued several times. They also suggested a national hour of service waiver, which was issued by the U.S. Department of Transportation. So what are the long and short-term issues ahead? In the short term, the reports show this week that the crisis is trending toward improvement. The average price per gallon is $3.47, which is down 49 cents from a week ago, and $1.20 from 2 weeks ago. The high price, the high has dropped $1.75 over the past 2 weeks, from $5.90 to $4.25. So prices are clearly getting better, but are still much too high. A propane supply, we believe, is moving north, and the Conway, Kansas propane inventory has increased in the past week. But concerns still remain for keeping our supply up and prices down, and weather will play a big role in that. The good news is that the forecast for the next couple of weeks looks like warmer weather. That should help considerably. In the longer term, the Cochin pipeline will shut down, we believe, in April, and switch over from transporting propane from Canada to Minnesota. Infrastructure concerns will remain and, in fact, grow as a result of that. So we're going to be looking at every available option, from the transportation needs to terminals, and particularly the need for storage, increased storage capacity at terminals, and storage for farmers, business owners, and individuals who rely on propane as their main heating source. We were also asked what the Commerce Department's authority, regulatory authority, was on this issue and whether there are other steps that we could take to strengthen that authority. Currently, the Commerce Department houses the state's Energy Assurance Program for energy emergency planning and response. We work closely with the propane industry to provide up-to-date information on Minnesota's energy system, and the department's technical and analytical resources is a line of defense in limiting the health and safety impacts of energy supply emergencies, big and small, that happen every year. Additionally, Commerce administers the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program and provides energy assistance grants for Minnesotans at generally at 50% of the state median income. As I mentioned, we've since increased that for the remainder of this year. The combination of the two roles placed Commerce in a unique situation to lead the State Emergency Operations Center, and Governor Dayton has publicly authorized the Commissioner of Commerce to investigate consumer prices and complaints related to price gouging, price fixing, and any other market manipulation. Commissioner, in response, has issued a letter to the Propane Association reminding the industry that the practices listed above will be monitored and acted upon. And the department staff, the State Emergency Operations Center, to take calls on financial assistance, emergency situations, and consumer complaints. There may be other steps that we're going to want to take to strengthen the authority that exists, and we are collecting those suggestions now and from all of you and from stakeholders, and would welcome any thoughts that the commission has today on that. Moving forward, the department is and will be reviewing options to increase our authority in the propane marketplace, and there may be some items for possible legislative consideration in that. So with that, Mr. Chairman, be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Grant. You said something about a $17 million LIHEAP thing. Is that contingent on whether the federal government increases or not, and when will we know that?
Mr. Chairman and members, yes, although I don't expect at this point that we're going to wait for the federal government to act. As I mentioned, we anticipate a mid-March date when we will run out of money in the energy assistance program without additional funds. So I expect a request to the legislature will be coming to you early in the session.
Thank you. Representative Hackbarth and Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been getting a couple of complaints from constituents that are on propane, and they signed an agreement with their propane company for a set price for the winter, and now with this crisis that we're in, they're seeing bills that are coming where they're not agreeing to the set price that they agreed to with their contract. And not only is the price higher, but there's additional fees for transportation, et cetera. So these constituents are saying, what can I do about this? I mean, all I could say is, well, maybe you can take them to court for breach of contract or something like that. Mm-hmm. How can we address this issue, and what are you seeing that we can do to remedy this? Because they just think these people are gouging them. They expect the government to do something to fix this problem.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hackbarth, yes, that's consistent with complaints that we also received at the State Emergency Operations Center. And we are recording all of the complaints that we received, including those, and we'll be working with the industry to remedy those situations once we get through this crisis situation. We're aware that some customers who had prepaid for propane in the summer at a fixed price were either told that they would have to wait for propane to be delivered to them, or were told that they couldn't be delivered at that price. And that raises a real concern for us at the department. We will be following up on those cases.
So should we keep people be encouraging their constituents to contact the department with their complaints as well?
Mr. Chairman, that would be a great idea. They can do that either through the Emergency Operations Center while that call line is still up, or by calling the department directly.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And first of all, I want to thank Mr. Grant for talking about the triage measures that have been taken. My district, I've never experienced an issue like this in the 9 years that I've been in the legislature. A lot of people are out there hurting right now. And at the federal level, the state level, the propane industry has done their best in a triage situation. And I appreciate your openness to take suggestions for long-term solutions, and I'll talk about one suggestion I would like to give for a long-term solution to this in a bit. But first of all, with regards to the 60% requirement, 60% of median income, that's the maximum threshold at the federal level. Do the federal regulations prohibit the state of Minnesota from offering its own supplementary program, which would have a higher income eligibility test? As you know, 60% of median income is not a lot of money. And there are people in my district, you know, they don't fill up propane tanks beyond 80% full, for obviously because it expands and can cause issues. But there's people in our area who make $55,000, $60,000 a year for a family, and they're never going to qualify for any of this federal or state assistance. Is that an option that can be considered as to, at a one-time basis, not a permanent change in policy, but to help these people who are having $1,500 and $2,000 propane bills?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Garofalo, yes, a state-funded supplement to the LIHEAP program could set its own income eligibility guidelines above those that are set by the federal government. That's certainly an option that we could look at. The projection that we made on the need for additional funds was based on keeping the threshold at 60%. So be aware that as you go up the income scale, the cost of serving those additional households will also increase the total cost.
Absolutely.
Of the program.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, thank you. So with regards to, and I respect that, and that's true. I think the administration has responded well. The federal response has been good, too, but we're triaging. So in a long-term perspective, there's one of the, in the beginning of your presentation, you listed the causes for this event. And was that did a third party supply you with those, or was that the Commerce Department's assessment?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Garofalo, that's our assessment, and I believe as well as the industry's assessment.
Okay.
of how the situation developed.
Because, Mr. Chairman, to the testifier, there's one item that was missing from there that is a bigger problem that continues to manifest itself in Minnesota, and that is the fact that our railways in Minnesota are absolutely jammed with oil tankers coming out of North Dakota. And it goes beyond the issue of getting propane from where it's at to where it's needed. We're seeing the North Star commuter rails getting screwed up. There's now problems with getting the supply of cement into the Twin Cities region. On top of that, we now see reports that we are completely unprepared for an oil fire or an oil tanker explosion like they had in North Dakota. And so that these portfolio of issues is related to the issue of propane, because we're always going to have bad weather, unexpected weather. There's always going to be unexpected supply disruptions. But the ability to get those commodities from where they are to where they are needed is the problem that we are having right now. And the administration has been very vocal in making suggestions to the federal government, and I would have a very simple suggestion that the Governor Dayton and the administration could support, and that is to build the Keystone Pipeline and get it done. That will reduce the amount of oil tankers going through Minnesota by 60% to 70%. It will solve the North Star issue. It will solve the other problems we're seeing with oil tanker fire potential in Minnesota, as well as the propane supply issues, because there's going to be more cold winters we're not expecting. There's going to be supply disruptions we don't expect. There's plenty of propane in the United States. It's just a matter of getting that to the north and having a flexible transportation infrastructure that allows the delivery of those propanes would be a huge benefit as a result of the Keystone Pipeline. And I'll just reinforce my position on that and ask that the governor and his administration please consider that. Thank you.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Didn't this originally start, aside from the cold weather, because there was something happening to the pipeline distribution? One of the pipelines was shutting down or making ready to ship something else on their pipeline?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Representative Earhart. As I mentioned, the Kinder Morgan's Cochin pipeline, which supplies about 40% of the propane into the Minnesota market currently, did shut down for 3 weeks in December and plans to permanently not shut down, but be reversed and not carry propane to Minnesota any longer in April.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Grant, isn't there something that can be done about the pipeline aspect of letting them shut down, or don't we have anything to say about that? Who governs the pipelines?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Earhart, pipelines fall under federal jurisdiction, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. They are what is known as common carriers, and they provide transportation services for those who are willing to pay to be transported. One of the difficulties with propane generally is it's a very peaky load. We use almost no propane in the summer and uncertain amounts in the fall and winter. And for that reason, shippers are less inclined to want to make room available on their pipelines for propane than they are for other products that have a more steady demand.
Well, I guess my question is, Mr. Chairman, that in this crisis, couldn't have that have been reversed instead of them shutting down? Couldn't somebody given the order to go full blast on importing instead of adding to the problem?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Earhart, as I mentioned, the governor did ask, along with others, that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission encourage all pipelines through their emergency powers to ship propane as a priority during the crisis. The state of Minnesota does not have the authority on its own to order a pipeline to move product.
Well, I understand that from what you said, but isn't there a moral suasion that someone in this goddamn government could have said, put propane through there because we got people that don't have it? That's my question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, I believe that's exactly what we did.
Well, it wasn't strong enough.
Mr. Chairman, just a fact for Representative Earhart. He should know that the supplies up in Edmonton have actually been diminished. They use propane in Canada as well. So even if the pipeline had been open, it's some debate about what the pressure would be and how much they could really be getting through to Minnesota. That's why the FERC ordered the change that's coming up from, I think it's Texas.
Yes.
Is where the first time in their history they did it. So there was a response to it, but yelling at people to get propane to a place where they don't have any on the supply chain really wouldn't have done much, Representative Earhart.
Well, certainly, Representative Garofalo, there is a fault there in what the pipeline decided to do. Is that correct? They decided to shut down their supply because they want to make more money shipping something else on it. And they ignored the fact that we are having a terrible winter here in North. seems to me that that's a responsibility that somebody could have dealt with.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Grant, do you know why was the Kinder Morgan pipeline shut down for 3 weeks in December?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hortman, it is because they are preparing for a permanent shutdown and reversal of the line in April, and there are pumping stations on the line that had to be converted to handle that reversal.
Just a follow-up. So at the time that they made the decision to shut down the pipeline for 3 weeks in December, were they aware of the propane shortage because of the late spring and the wet crops and the usage in the winter?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Hortman, they were certainly aware that we'd had a wet season and lots of demand for drying, and they couldn't have known at that time that we were going to have as cold a winter as we did.
Thank you.
Mr. Grant, in your conversations with the industry, are they, when you say 40% is coming in through that pipeline and it won't be next winter, are they comfortable, or are you comfortable that they're ready for that? Do we have the storage supplies here to build up what has to happen in the next year?
Mr. Chairman, as a result of the meeting that we had, that Governor Dayton had with propane suppliers, railroads, trucking firms, and others in October, I believe, a number of companies have indicated to us since then that they are busily adding storage capacity to address the fact that the Kinder Morgan line is going to be reversed. It's not clear to us at this point whether that's going to be an adequate response to replacing the 40% of supply that we're losing. And this is going to be an ongoing issue, and one that the administration and our department is going to be actively working on well after the propane crisis is out of the news for this year.
You have it?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chairman, thank you. I'm happy to hear that the administration responded the way they did, and that they're being very aggressive in how they're pursuing this, because it seems to me that we knew how much propane was being used when we were drying crops, and that winter was coming. And if we're using an abnormal amount of propane during that period of time, it would seem to me that production should have increased, or that supply should have increased to Minnesota or whoever needed the propane at the time, because we knew we were using the propane in an abnormal amount. And it's whether the winter was an extremely cold winter or it was just winter, we need propane. But in my mind, I don't care what the laws of supply and demand say, they don't justify a 5 and 600% increase in the price of propane. So I hope that the government gets very, very serious and very, very aggressive in pursuing what just happened and make sure it doesn't happen again. And finally, I know that we're on top of this, and that is that the new guidelines that the governor has proposed, and rightfully so, will result in about 120,000 people, if I'm not mistaken, being eligible for the extra incentive payments. And I doubt that many will access the money. Maybe 30 to 40,000 will access the money. But it's important that we have enough money available for the people that are there, and that we get it immediately, because the people who are already in the queue, such as the seniors who are expecting their payments, will be leapfrogged as a result of this emergency status that these people are acquiring. And so I just want to make sure that we have enough money to take care of everybody.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. Any other questions or so for Mr. Grant? I do have one more. Just could you give me a scope of how big this 40% of supply is? What is our consumption in Minnesota? What do we have to store up next year to make up for that?
Mr. Chairman, a good question. I can certainly get that information for you. I don't have it off the top of my head.
Appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative. Representative Falk, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just a question for Mr. Grant. I know we can't tell Kinder Morgan exactly how to run their business, and that's not something we should be doing, but has there been any inquiry about why the decision to go and service a pipeline was made in the middle of December? It just seems that, I mean, even if the flow is going to be reversed come April, that the coldest part of the year to do maintenance is a little bit, you know, interesting, to maybe say the least. And I don't want to say that, you know, they would know that, you know, taking that supply off the market would cause a price to spike, but will the department be looking to see if there was any intentional, I wouldn't want to say price fixing, but means to go and have the conditions for the prices to increase?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Falk, absolutely, we will be looking at that. Kinder Morgan did delay by several weeks the outage that they had in December that was scheduled to have occurred earlier, largely because they were aware that so much propane had been used for grain drying. So there was some flexibility on their part, but apparently this move to reverse the line had been in their business plan for some time. And we will be looking to make sure that was not a situation of price manipulation or fixing, as you say.
We will look forward to
Senator
Sanchin.
Just a couple of quick ones and just brief answer. You make several references about price gouging, et cetera, et cetera. Was any of that established, at least to date?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Sanchin, no, we have those cases under investigation.
Okay. And the other one, I was just kind of looking at a more national profile of propane, and we seem to be talking a little bit, at least, about harvest and drying crops. But, you know, it seems to me elevated propane prices are almost a national. At least the charts I see talk about the East Coast and Mid-America and so on, and it's the problem's there as well, it seems. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sanchin, it is absolutely correct. States across the northern tier of the country through the Midwest and out to the Northeast were affected by this same situation and continue to be.
And is there an agricultural component to the problems in those other states? I mean, did they have a planting and harvest season like we alleged to have?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Sanchin, I can't really speak to the situations on the ground in those other states. I'm assuming that a number of the Midwestern states are also agricultural states and would have been impacted in a similar way.
Okay. Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. My question to you, Mr. Grant, that we talk a little bit about the propane shortages this fall. I heard a lot from a lot of my producers with the wet fall. It was my understanding that Governor Dayton did receive a letter to open up the hours of service. Back then, I believe did anything happen at that time when I think there was already a kind of an earlier shortage? How did Governor Dayton respond to that earlier request to kind of open up that hours of service to bring extra propane into the state?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, in every case where we were asked to extend an hour of service waiver, the governor responded by doing so.
Further question? If not, I think both of our committees are going to be interested in updates
as
the weeks come along, because the next few weeks, I think, are still we're not out of the crisis yet, and I also think there's big fear about next year, especially with the loss of the 40%. Thank you.
Senator Tomasoni?
No, I asked my question. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. Sorry. Just popped into my head. So, delivered fuel, propane, we may or may not have this kind of crisis for folks in future years. I think folks are probably feeling really vulnerable at this point. Are we thinking about some larger policy solutions, some larger technology solutions, alternatives, so folks maybe occupy a slightly better position in the marketplace, more leverage? Propane may be the only option for some folks located in some areas, but I'm just wondering if we're going to try to unpack some of the larger systemic issues.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dibble, absolutely. We're looking at every conceivable option for increasing supply into the state. I plan on meeting on Friday with natural gas company representatives to talk about line extensions into areas presently not served by natural gas to begin that process. But we will be talking with the railroads, with the trucking. We will be exploring every option.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Brown.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to touch on a little bit of what Senator Dibble just asked. Being that we see a move away from fossil fuels, is this not an opportunity for the Department of Commerce to promote alternative non-fossil fuels that people could use?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Brown, that's a great question and a great segue to a report that you'll be hearing a little bit later on about solar thermal, a study that we prepared at the legislature's request. That is one of the options for people who are presently heating with propane.
Thank you for coming. We look forward to continuing updates from you on a regular basis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next, we have, we have a presentation from Rocky Mountain Institute on the energy scoping study. Lena Hansen is here to make a presentation, and I believe we have a big packet in our packets, PowerPoint thing in our packets. Welcome to the committee, to the commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the commission. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today about some work we did on scoping an energy future study for the state of Minnesota. First, let me just introduce Rocky Mountain Institute. For those of you who are not familiar with our organization, RMI is a 33-year-old 501c3 nonprofit based in Colorado, but we work nationally. And our goal is to advance market-based solutions that transform global energy use, that engage business and communities and institutions to find a way to cost-effectively transition energy systems from fossil fuels to efficiency and renewables. First, I'd like to provide some context on the study that we did and the purpose of it. Legislation required the Department of Commerce to scope an energy future study to look at how Minnesota can achieve a sustainable energy system that does not rely on the burning of fossil fuels. This was the guiding principle for the study that we did that I will be talking about today. I did want to mention as well additional legislation that the Legislative Energy Commission shall develop a framework for Minnesota to transition to a renewable energy economy that ends Minnesota's contribution to greenhouse gases from burning fossil fuels within the next few decades. These two pieces of work are very closely tied together, and the work that we've done to scope the Energy Future Study will inform the ongoing framework process by this commission. The purpose of the Energy Future Scoping Report that we did was threefold. First, to identify the value proposition for Minnesota to conduct an energy future study. What is the point? What can be gained from doing this type of study? The second purpose was to provide clear guidance around critical study scope considerations to ensure that Minnesota can efficiently and effectively conduct the energy future study. This type of work is very complex, and it's critical to have a clear sense around what the scope should be before getting started. And then the third purpose was to provide a foundation from which Minnesota stakeholders and this commission can start to have an action-oriented dialogue around the future of energy in the state. This is really important because in our view and in the view of the Department of Commerce and others, an energy future study in and of itself is not all that useful. In fact, it's only useful if it really drives action and enables an ongoing dialogue among Minnesota stakeholders. Along these lines, Minnesota is in a group of leaders around the world and around the country who are asking these questions, but is by no means alone. As part of our work on the Energy Future Study, we reviewed 10 other studies, 4 at a state or regional level, 3 at the U.S. national level, a couple European, and 1 global. There are many others. We reviewed these 10. By and large, they all looked at how it might be possible to reduce fossil fuel consumption in their regions by between 80 and 100%, in most cases by 2050, and in a few cases by 2030. Importantly, as we began our work on scoping the energy future study, we engaged a number of Minnesota stakeholders. We had over 200 Minnesotans join us for a day-long stakeholder meeting at the beginning of this process to provide input. And of those, 70 followed up with extensive written comments, which really helped us shape and scope the design of the Energy Future Study. These are just a few examples of some of the institutions who provided written comments that we took into account. There were also many, many individuals who provided comments. A few key themes that came out of that, these may not be that surprising particularly, but I think reiterate the importance of them, is first the criticality of assessing both affordability and reliability of this transition, that moving to clean energy in and of itself is insufficient. You must do so in a way that is affordable and that maintains the level of reliability that Minnesotans have come to expect from their energy system. Second, there was broad support for focusing on a wide range of commercially available technologies, but within the context and the recognition of emerging technologies and how quickly technology is developing and opening up new opportunities. And then third, the importance of deep stakeholder engagement and transparent nonpartisan process. The idea here is that, again, this kind of work can only be successful when it comes from the people who it will affect, that co-creating an energy future study and strategy is, in fact, a key to success. And transparency around the analysis and the process for doing that is a key enabler. So let me just say a couple things about why an energy future study is important and relevant. First, I want to point out that Minnesota's energy future is choice, not fate. That, in fact, doing nothing is a choice. There are a lot of options facing the state and a lot of changing trends that mean that whatever happens will be different than the state of energy in the past in Minnesota. I'll talk about a number of those. But that led us to really ask two questions in our scoping report. The first one was, what does a clean energy future look like for Minnesota? And then the second is, how do we get there? And these together are critical questions that the ultimate energy future study needs to ask to be able to understand what is actually important and relevant for the state. This is a long list. I tried hard to shorten it. I was unable to do so because I think they're all important. So let me give you the six reasons why we believe that an energy future study is important for the state of Minnesota. And I should just first add a caveat that by energy future study, we mean both a rigorous analytical study of what the future may hold and what the possibilities may be, but also the stakeholder process and framework that accompanies that. So an energy future study along those lines will allow Minnesota to first prepare for the future in a way that maximizes benefits and minimizes risks for the state's citizens and businesses. As I said, there's a lot changing, and unless we take a thoughtful approach to understand what those trends are and what they may mean, there will be both risks and opportunities that may be missed. Second, to create a more predictable business environment, to reveal new economic development opportunities, and to meet the state's environmental and quality of life goals. Many businesses around the country are asking for clarity about the status of energy investments and energy trends everywhere, because that's critical for their ability to make smart investment decisions. Third, to avoid misallocating resources, missing economic opportunities, and being overly reactive. Fourth, to engage diverse stakeholders in weighing the risks and opportunities of different paths forward, and to come to a collective agreement about where we want to head. Fifth, to bring clarity and coherence to Minnesota's energy strategy and to channel efforts towards a common goal. We find frequently in our work around the country that having a clear and compelling vision and goal, in fact, inspires an incredible amount of action, of entrepreneurialism. And last, to recognize, as I mentioned on the previous slide, that there is no such thing as doing nothing. Choices will be made, whether by default or design, and therefore this is an important opportunity to take control of the future of energy in Minnesota. So I'd like to talk for a few minutes about some of the trends that we see and that we looked into as part of this scoping study that to us indicate that the future will be different than the past, no matter what. First, let me just say by way of background that currently 72% of Minnesota's energy comes from fossil fuels. You can see the mix here. About a third of that is petroleum for transportation. The rest is a combination of gas, coal, and then some renewables and nuclear that largely fuel electricity and heating. So there are six trends that I'd like to talk through briefly. Here they are: economic development and energy independence, desire for increased resiliency, customer empowerment and competitive advantage, technology and price evolution, appropriately directing needed investment, and shifting action on climate and environment. So let me touch on each of these. First, economic development and energy independence. You all have probably seen this statistic before. Currently, the state of Minnesota exports about $13 billion a year to pay for fossil fuels that almost entirely come from out of the state and or out of the country. That's almost equivalent to Minnesota's entire tax burden and is equivalent to the cost of all of Minnesota's teachers, police officers, 30,000 small business entrepreneurship loans, and 10,000 new affordable homes, with about $1 billion left over. So it's really quite a lot of money that the state of Minnesota spends on fossil fuels that goes out of the state. This means that there's a huge opportunity to find ways to keep some of that money in the state. Just as a small example, Rocky Mountain Institute worked recently with a small community in Colorado, Fort Collins, where we looked at this question very closely and found that they, again, very small community, not a state, were exporting about $50 million a year for fossil fuels. But by transitioning to clean energy resources, especially local clean energy resources, they would be able to keep $30 million in the community as investment in those resources. The other important thing to mention here, because it's talked about very frequently, is the ability of any type of resource, in this case clean energy resources, to create jobs. From 2010 to 2011 in the U.S. as a whole, jobs in energy efficiency and renewable energy grew by 26%, which far outpaced job growth in other areas of the economy. Second, there's an increased desire for resiliency of especially our electricity system. Hurricane Sandy in the Northeast cost between $14 and $26 billion in economic damages. Minnesota as well recently experienced summer storms affecting more than 500 million people. In the news recently, there have been recent attacks on substations in California and in Arkansas that are getting now national news, although they were about a year ago. And all of these things together, both natural causes and man-made causes of grid failure, are driving increased interest and investment in distributed resources, in microgrids. The states of New York and Connecticut are in the process of investigating and launching significant investment programs in community-based microgrids in response to these issues. The third thing I'd like to talk about is customer empowerment and competitive advantage. Minnesota's five largest companies have set greenhouse gas targets or made significant progress in reducing their greenhouse gas emissions. These are they. But businesses, industries, and individuals all across the board are increasingly focusing on the role of energy efficiency in reducing costs and the role of efficiency in renewables in meeting their climate and sustainability targets. These range from Rupert Murdoch's company News Corp, which went carbon neutral recently for the purpose of cost savings, In RMI's experience, has also ranged from mining, oil refining, semiconductor fabs, all the way to the Walmarts of the world and Google. Across the patch, we see corporations really looking at these issues very closely and taking significant action. Much of that really is about expanding customer choice and opening the market to meet evolving customer needs and the desire for not a one-size-fits-all answer. Technology and price evolution. Just a few things here. Large-scale wind has recently, I believe, dipped below $30 a megawatt hour, which is now less expensive than a 20-year natural gas contract. That's really profound. 3 cents a kilowatt hour for wind in this part of the world is in many ways a game changer, and now in some places the least cost option. Solar module prices have fallen 75% since 2008. And battery technology has similarly evolved. RMI will be releasing a report next week with an analysis of when the combination of solar and storage may mean that customers could cost effectively defect from the grid, which is no way a good decision from a system point of view, but may actually happen before 2030 in much of the country. These trends together mean that technology and cost reductions of these technologies are significantly changing both the opportunities that customers face and the overall calculus of how we invest in our electricity system and our energy system more broadly. What we see really is 20th century business models and institutions that are colliding with 21st century technologies, and the need, therefore, to find ways to evolve the business models and regulations that govern our energy industry to allow all resources to compete fairly and allow, in the process, for the continuation of a thriving electricity grid that supports that system. By 2030 or 2033, Minnesota's two nuclear power plants will be likely to retire. That represents almost a quarter of Minnesota's electricity production. And by 2017, more than 50% of Minnesota's coal plants will be more than 40 years old, which means that in the coming decades, a significant portion of current power plants will be retiring. Nationally, there's an expectation of more than $2 trillion of investment needed in the electricity system over the next 15 years. And in Minnesota, that's likely to be multiple billions of dollars. So energy infrastructure assets are uniquely long-lived, which means that as these assets begin to retire and need to be replaced, this is the time to ask the question, where do we want to spend that money? And what bets are we willing to be locked into when we make those decisions? Finally, shifting action on climate and environment. Minnesota has a goal to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions 15% by 2015. It is now at about 3%, and so there's a gap there still. Nationally, the Environmental Protection Agency is releasing regulations that will affect new and potentially existing coal-fired power plants. And what's really interesting is that both banks and insurance companies around the world are starting to sound the alarm on this point. Recently, the Reinsurance Association of America said that the industry is at great financial peril if it does not understand global and regional climate impacts. And also just recently, just this winter, both Time and the Washington Post and a number of others have reported on the polar vortex that we are all experiencing around the country right now and the potential ties to climate change. So whether you care most about energy security, about economic development, about climate change, these forces and trends are so different from our past experience that it is prudent and important to thoughtfully look ahead, as many businesses do now, as electric utilities do now, and many others, and plan to maximize the opportunity that Minnesota has and minimize the risks that face its citizens. So if we wanted to do that, what would an energy future study entail? This really is what we've proposed as the guiding question for the Minnesota Future Study, Energy Future Study. How far and how fast can Minnesota transition to a clean energy system while maintaining affordability and energy reliability for its citizens and businesses? We've proposed testing 80% and 100% clean energy by 2050, and then considering a sensitivity around what that would look like even to 2030. It's critical in doing so to look at all sectors of Minnesota's energy economy, including buildings, industry, agriculture, transportation, and electricity. And in doing so, to recognize that the purpose is not clean energy for the sake of clean energy. It's clean energy for the sake of meeting Minnesota's goals, which are several. That includes environmental quality, but importantly also includes maintaining affordability for its citizens, reliability of the system, maximizing economic development opportunities, minimizing public health impacts, and minimizing risks. And that all of these criteria need to be considered and analyzed in depth so that people really have the information they need to make smart trade-offs between the different energy investment options and pathways forward that exist. There are several key questions that the Energy Future Study must answer. Several of these I've touched on, but they're important, so I will reiterate. Number one, how much of Minnesota's future energy needs can be met with clean energy and in what time frame? Can it be done affordably? Could it do so while maintaining or improving both reliability and resilience of the energy system? What could be gained in terms of environmental and human health impacts? How might various future energy scenarios create competitive advantage and drive in-state economic development for Minnesota? And finally, and very, very importantly, what near-term and no-regrets actions would set the state up for success? Let me talk just for a moment about this last point. Most importantly, and I said this earlier on, the Energy Future Study should not just be a study. In fact, I decided earlier today that we should recast it not as a study and rather as the Minnesota Energy Action Plan process or something to that effect, to reflect the fact that producing a study that sits on a shelf is a waste of time and a waste of money, that in fact it must involve key stakeholders from the start and it must be action-oriented. Analysis, in fact, informs prudent, pragmatic action. With a clear path forward to action and a clear sense of signposts that help decision makers in Minnesota understand the changing landscape and when, therefore, the strategy may need to change. An energy future study, therefore, must focus on what, but also on how. So we've proposed a four very big step process. First, to assemble the right team. To pull together a core team of decision makers from across the state who can form a leadership group, as well as strategies for engaging the public more broadly. Then to align on what the objective is, the definition of the system we're really looking at, what sectors we want to look at, and the analytical approach, much of which we've proposed in the Energy Future Study scoping document. But it's critical to build ownership among stakeholders around those things and to be really clear around what the priorities of the state are for its energy future. A third, to assess the feasibility of different scenarios, to develop a strategic vision, and to build recommendations. So this is the step where there's a lot of technical detail. I am not going to bore you with it here. We could talk about it for hours. But what I do want to say is that the goal of this work is to take something that can be very complex, to make it manageable, which it absolutely is, and to use it not to drive absolute precision, but rather to create a shared vision and a pathway that is informed by rigorous analysis. As I mentioned, stakeholder engagement is critical to the success, the ultimate success of this work. We've proposed three types of stakeholder engagement. which will take different forms to engage different audiences. The broad public to inform, to review the work that is being done, a core leadership team of stakeholders to guide, review, plan, and help conduct the study, and then detailed working groups to tackle the many very complex parts of this question. So what will it take to do this energy future study? One, clarity of purpose and commitment to a process that doesn't just produce a study but also drives productive action. That requires a new way of engaging each other and a new way of engaging stakeholders. In-depth, diverse, and ongoing stakeholder engagement. It requires resources, both in time and money. This type of work, which we've benchmarked with other energy strategy work like this around the country, we estimate with the stakeholder engagement process proposed, $1.5 to $2 million. There may be interesting and creative opportunities here for public-private partnerships to fund this work. And finally, broad engagement and leadership from key decision makers around the state, including this commission. So finally, let me just say that to my earlier point, Minnesota's energy future really is choice, not fate. It's our choice what we want to do and where we want to be in the future. And so the Energy Future Study represents a unique and important opportunity to choose thoughtfully and to choose well. I am happy to take your questions, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you could go back about eight slides, I had a question on the chart titled Shifting Action on Climate and Environment. Yes. This seems to indicate that carbon emissions has been on the increase since 1990 in Minnesota, but yet the White House issued the President's Climate Action Plan last June, and in the very first page of that report, it says that carbon emissions from the energy sector fell to the lowest level in two decades. That seems to contradict what we're looking at here. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I can say a few words about it, and thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Brown. In this chart, carbon emissions in Minnesota and around the country have risen significantly over the last couple decades. They've fallen in the last few years, in part due to the economic downturn and in part due to a shift from coal to natural gas. That combination of factors has resulted in a significant decline in U.S. carbon emissions, but by no means are we on track based on long-term plans or trajectories or at a low point in the last several decades.
So, I was just trying to understand. That was one of the most surprising statements in that report that the White House issued, saying that carbon emissions fell to the lowest level in two decades. That just doesn't seem to be indicated in this chart that we're looking at. I'm just curious as why the disparity there.
Yeah. As I said, I do believe that carbon emissions have fallen significantly in the last several years. I don't have the information at hand to know how that compares nationally for the last two decades, but I know that the reasons for that shift, some are likely permanent in terms of the shift from coal to natural gas and in terms of the growth of renewables across the country over the last few years, and other reasons, particularly the economic downturn, are unlikely to be sustained.
Thank you.
Further questions? If not, Senator St. John.
Thank you very much. As you're going through, some of us, or at least, you know, I came to this legislature based on life experience and learning after I got here that the concept of baseload energy was important. And there was a study that the Department of Commerce did a couple of years ago. I'm trying to remember the name of it, but it was a hallmark study, and it talked about at least electrical energy use projectedly in the state of Minnesota going forward, and that probably needs to be updated. I don't know, but as we think about studying, as we think about Minnesota's energy future, and again going back to baseload, this sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. Is the concept of baseload energy and creating a base energy source important yet, or is that important weaning in the light of renewable energy options? I don't know if I've articulated this very well, but
no, absolutely. And thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum. This is the issue you're referring to around the variability of wind and solar is a critical one and being addressed really extensively around the industry. Rocky Mountain Institute and some of our other work works on this issue as well. The challenge, of course, as you've stated, is that wind and solar are variable. The sun doesn't shine at night. Wind doesn't blow all the time. And that presents a problem for the way the industry has historically operated the electricity grid. A couple thoughts on that. One is that, in fact, utilities have been very good at managing variability in load, in that they can't control when we turn our light switch on and do our dishes for years. And so the idea of variability in the electricity system is not a new one, and one that utility operators work on consistently. It becomes much more difficult when you have not only variable demand but also variable supply. RMI has done some extensive modeling on this point in collaboration with the National Renewable Energy Lab to look at the possibilities for how to operate an 80% variable renewable electricity system reliably on an hourly basis, and found that that looks to be absolutely possible. That the concept of baseload that you refer to, which is the importance of having a flat source of generation that produces the same amount all the time, is increasingly not that important. That what's important really is having a portfolio of resources that can be managed together and coordinated in a way that maintains reliability, much like conducting an orchestra. That having, you know, one instrument play the same note all the time is not as important as having all of the instruments play their part and be able to work together in the right way. And so operating a highly renewable system without baseload is likely to be possible. Now, that needs to be continued to be studied. I know that the state of Minnesota is currently engaging in a follow-up study to look at the operational impacts of running a highly renewable system in the state and surrounding region. So it's a topic that deserves continued study, but there's little to indicate thus far that it's going to present a not overcomable challenge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Nothing I disagreed with, but my question is, it kind of goes back to all the different studies that you reviewed. How is this effort different than stuff that we've done in the recent past? How does this add new value, new information? I think I know the answer, but I think we need to just talk about that. Because I think about, for example, the Minnesota Climate Change Action Group report, or you just talked about how to build a system that's highly responsive to renewables when the wind isn't blowing in one place but in another, or the sun isn't shining over here but over here. I feel like we've studied that before and gotten the answer to that. So we struggle with this question all the time. Another report, how does this add new and additional value? The MCAG is one of those that we were really excited about for a while, sat on the shelf, got pretty dusty. But we have representatives of the EQB here. I think they're going to breathe new life into that effort. So what are we doing here that answers questions that haven't been answered already?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble. A few thoughts on that point. It's a great question. I think that, while there are studies from other states and from other parts of the world that have looked at this broad question of the energy future, none of those have been specifically targeted at Minnesota, and every state is different, and it's critical to look at that coordinated integrated strategy in the context of what's unique about Minnesota. That's one. The second thing is, while there have been a lot of very important and notable efforts previously here in Minnesota, there hasn't really been, and one of the things that the Energy Futures Study can serve to do is to tie all those threads together, to take a whole system integrated look at energy, because it is becoming more integrated. We're seeing new connections between transportation and electricity, between home heating and electricity, that have not been the case before. And so taking the opportunity to build on the very important work that has happened thus far and tie that together and extend it forward is another important value add and purpose of this report. And then the other thing I would say is that this provides an opportunity via stakeholder engagement and the framework to engage people more fundamentally and directly in creating the future that they want, and in that way to be able to support action planning and support strategic planning in a way that has a very good chance of making impact and driving real action and change, because people want to make those changes and see the value that it can provide. So we view the Energy Future Study as a build on the body of work that has thus far happened and an opportunity to advance that with stakeholders in Minnesota, with decision makers in Minnesota, and figure out together, collectively, the path forward.
Representative Falk and Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess, we've seen a lot of studies in the legislature, and just would like to share with the committee that a few years ago, we had a 100% renewable study done for Minnesota. I sent a link to Ms. Levinson Falk here to share with the committee, but this was put together by Dr. Arjun Makajani at the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, and that was using pre-2012 cost numbers and the technologies available, and basically costed out what it would cost to go 100% renewable, and it deals with energy storage issues using compressed air technologies and some things such as that. But it's a good report, and oftentimes a lot of reports are not looked at, but I'd encourage members to take a look at that one.
Thank you. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the question comes to kind of think what you just stated a little bit earlier, and we heard about the propane shortage that is impacted not just Minnesota, and so there's the complexities of the interaction and the inclusion of many other states around us. Does this report look at how we are in relationship to the rest of the states? I mean, earlier you mentioned individuals could come off the grid, shall we say, but you said that wouldn't be a good idea for the system, meaning that we do have infrastructure set up now for a lot of providing of electricity and other energy sources. Do you suggest how we can incorporate that so that we're not kind of at reliance on other states and other areas as well, or how does that work?
Yeah, what we've suggested in the scoping study is that you're absolutely right that Minnesota sits within a regional context, and there's an energy infrastructure, especially in the electricity system, across that region. Okay. And therefore, understanding the future of energy and electricity in Minnesota is intertwined very much with what happens on the regional level. So this study and the analytics behind it would need to at least acknowledge that and analyze the larger region, including the MISO, Independent System Operator region, more broadly, and that investments made elsewhere will impact investments in Minnesota too. So one of the main goals of the study is to really understand if Minnesota takes a particular course of action, whatever it may be, what are the consequences and what are the potential unintended consequences of doing so in terms of stranded assets or missed opportunities or the inability or ability of customers to take one action or another. So those system linkages between Minnesota and other states, and between the sectors within Minnesota, and between the different types of investments that are made and the different stakeholders who that those costs and those revenues accrue to. All of those interlinkages are very important, and we've proposed that they be addressed comprehensively, which really is one of the reasons why this type of energy future study is important, because it provides that opportunity to understand connections between things that are frequently looked at in a piecemeal way.
Okay, thank you.
I think that the one point you made about that, I think you will recognize that there's no such thing as doing nothing. Choices are made, whether by default or design. Yeah, change is happening in the industry and across the economy, and I think the important thing is make sure that we look at it in a logical way and make the decision rather than let it happen by default sometimes. But we will undoubtedly be talking more in the future and so on as I think people digest this and so on. So are there any other comments or questions? We have a couple other reports we wanted to have presented as well. If not, Ms. Hansen, thank you very much for presenting the report. The next one is the Energy Savings Goal Report from Department of Commerce, Jessica Burdett.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to come present to you today on the energy savings goal study that we conducted over this last 6 months. My name is Jessica Burdett, and I work for the Department of Commerce Division of Energy Resources. I supervise the Conservation Improvement Program. In 2013, House File 729, the Fourth Engrossment Article 12, was passed that established the energy savings goal study. This legislation directed the Department of Commerce to conduct stakeholder meetings to produce a report on findings and legislative recommendations. In this study, we were directed to clarify statewide energy savings policies, develop strategies to maximize energy efficiency and reduce emissions, look at combined heat and power as a resource, maximize long-term cost-effective savings and reduction of energy waste, look at energy efficiency with regard to resource planning and appropriate financial incentives for utilities and their energy efficiency efforts. In this study, we approached this by looking at a series of stakeholder meetings. We held two general stakeholder meetings to address higher level topics with different key stakeholders and panels of with utilities, other industrial stakeholders, regulatory agencies, and environmental advocacy groups. We also decided to break down some more specific topics around industrial efficiency and combined heat and power. So we held different technical working groups to address specific topics within industrial efficiency and some of the challenges that are faced with those customers, as well as looking at more specific issues around combined heat and power and how both those topics pertain to our energy savings goal. We, with these stakeholder meetings, developed straw man proposals to have our stakeholders respond to around different topics with industrial efficiency and combined power. We held public comment periods and ultimately took this information in to develop a report with findings and recommendations for your consideration. In our findings, we addressed the different strategies to maximize energy savings and to look at energy waste, utility costs, and rate impacts. We looked at energy conservation and renewable goals through resource planning and the certificate of need processes. And we also looked at what our current mechanisms are for evaluating utility financial incentives for their efficiency efforts. The specific recommendations that came from this report, these are very, very condensed, and in the report you'll find there's more discussion around these recommendations. But at a high level, the first recommendation was to explore and define a more specific policy objective behind Minnesota's energy efficiency policy goals. What is our end game and end goal for the achievement of energy savings and our annual energy savings goals? The second recommendation is to identify and take action specifically to help increase industrial energy efficiency. This is a topic that I think is widely recognized as having a lot of opportunity in this area, and we look to find more ways to increase these investments with this particular customer class. The third recommendation also is specific to industrial efficiency, and it's looking at the inclusion of sub-metering within industrial facilities and the inclusion of ISO 50001, which is a energy management system standard that was developed, and how we can include this in our current programs and in our current regulatory framework to help our industrial customers achieve greater efficiency. The fourth recommendation is to consider opportunities to utilize the E3 framework for energy efficiency assistance. E3 is a federal program that brings together multiple agencies, including Energy, Small Business Administration, Commerce, Pollution Control, and there's a couple others I can't remember off the top of my head, but to work within this framework to add to our already robust offering of energy savings programs. And then the fifth recommendation was to explore new financing programs that could be implemented within our current regulatory framework and that are not currently meeting the needs of customers that don't have financing programs available to them. With that, Bill is happy to take any questions you might have.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Grant, under number two on the previous page, the list of recommendations, you say actions are needed to help increase industrial energy efficiency investments. Like what? Is there a for example of what sorts of actions in that category we could take?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hortman, the two specific ones that do come up off the top of my head are related to better data, getting better data to industrial customers so that they can identify projects that will allow for priority implementation of efficiency. One of the challenges that we've recognized is that there are some larger, mid-sized to large industrial customers that have one meter, and it's very difficult to be able to identify projects when you're looking at one meter. It's hard to isolate different processes. It's hard to isolate different plug loads. And so getting better data to these customers so that they're able to make informed decisions and be able to use that data in their decision-making. Is that a good example?
That's one example. I have a follow-up. And with regard to the first one, you said define a more specific policy objective. Do you have something in mind that would be a better way to define it than what we have?
The context in which this came up was when we are looking at our energy savings goal, are we saving energy for the sake of saving energy, or are we saving energy for some other purpose, for instance, greenhouse gas emission reductions? And this comes in the context of the conversation of combined heat and power. With combined heat and power, there are potential not areas of concern, but we have to look at the emissions with combined heat and power systems. And so if we are including combined heat and power within our energy savings goal, how are we using that toward our goal?
OK.
I hope I'm not monopolizing, but with regard to combined heat and power, is the question there that it's, if you're just looking at saving money, then it's not an investment we would make, but if you're looking at preventing greenhouse gas emissions, then it is an investment we would make? Is that the kind of analysis you're talking about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Portman, I don't think that I would differentiate prioritizing projects, whether it's money saving or energy savings. Different customers have different motivations for implementing a project. With the combined heat and power, and this is discussed in the report when you have it, there are different challenges for looking at implementing a combined heat and power system than looking at, say, replacing a light bulb. So it's a much more complex application that is not just about energy, that there are a lot of other considerations than just energy savings when looking at combined heat and power.
Mr. Chair, if I might, Representative Portman, I mean, in the combined heat and power case, for example, you might be decreasing or increasing the amount of electricity you produce, but you're using more natural gas to do it. So is it an electrical energy efficiency program, but not one that we should be looking at as a gas conservation program, and vice versa? I mean, those are the kinds of issues that CHP projects often present for us.
Thank you.
Quick follow-up on Representative Portman's question, your response to her question on the industrial energy efficiency. When you were saying sub-metering and more information, is it, in other words, that some of the large industrial customers don't have enough data to know where they're using the power and what ways, and therefore what things make sense to do economically?
Mr. Chair, there's a couple different components. With the it varies. you can look at using more granular data with industrial systems, let's say 15-minute interval data, so that you can very granularly pinpoint where the need is to reduce energy, whether it's reducing energy or reducing demand. And so by providing that granularity of data, which currently many customers don't have access to, that you get your bill once a month and then you figure it out from there. So when you're able to access data of what you're demanding every 15 minutes, you're able to really identify, okay, here's where a challenge area is for us and here's where we can really focus our efforts. What's going on at 4 o'clock every afternoon that we're reaching our peak? And so that kind of information is something that's essential for identification of projects.
Questions from the committee? Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For sort of going to the same point on recommendation number three, obviously there's a cost with going to a certain level of granularity and sub-metering. Do you have any hard data or hard information on how much it would cost to go to certain levels of that granularity, and as well as the payback or the expected return on investment for going to that level? Is there a ratio that, based on every dollar you spend on going to a certain level, that you get $2 back, $3, whatever the case might be?
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmak, we have a couple of pilots that are in flight right now to start looking at those that level of information and looking at the paybacks, and that's something that has been studied. I don't have that information off the top of my head, but I'm more than happy to provide you with some of that.
Senator Dibble.
I suspect my questions could be answered by reading the report myself. Is it finished? Is it available?
It is finished and still under internal review, but okay. We'll have it in short order, I believe.
Great. Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So this is a report, of course, we asked for. I'm familiar with that. But Mr. Grant, is it your intention just to make it available to the legislature to do with what they see fit, or do you intend to bring forward any policy proposals as a result of
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, the recommendations, when they're available, what we've given you and what the report will include will be the recommendations from the consultant that we use to develop the stakeholder process and that we work with, is the Energy Center of Wisconsin. We are currently working with stakeholders to further those discussions in a number of areas. I don't think we have any recommendations that are actionable this legislative session, but all of that is still in process, and I would expect as we go forward, we will have recommendations for you, yes.
So in response to that, in other words, there are things that are going to come out of this, but they may not be this year.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion? If not, very much appreciate your presentation. And we, next one is the value of solar heating and cooling. Ms. Miller, welcome to the committee.
It takes three people to present.
Mr. Chair, members of the Commission, thank you for having me today. My name is Stacy Miller, and I work with the Department on Solar Programs and Solar Policy. And we'll be presenting today on the value of solar thermal study that was done, and asking you to not confuse this with the value of solar tariff that the Department recently submitted to the Public Utilities Commission. The two technologies are quite different. This one will deal exclusively with heating and cooling, while the solar tariff was about solar electricity. The project team was chosen by competitive bid and was headed up by Meister Consultants Group out of Boston, Massachusetts. They brought in local talent through CR Planning and Evergreen Energy to assist with the report, as well as an expert from NREL, the National Renewable Energy Lab, and Florida Solar Energy Center. And note that the title of this report was changed from the value of solar thermal to include value of solar heating and cooling, in recognition that the industry now acknowledges that solar thermal technologies can actually have cooling end applications. The report covers three different types of solar heating and cooling technologies. They're all a little different, but they do have in common the fact that they take the sunlight from the sun and use it to convert into useful heat energy or cooling energy as appropriate. And the three technologies were based on solar hot water, solar air heat, and transpired air heat. The latter might be a little less familiar to some people, but it is basically used for preheating intake air for commercial systems. And there are many end uses for these three technologies, including domestic hot water, space heating, industrial process heat, district heating, and others. The scope of work covered through this report included an overview of the different technology options within solar heating and cooling and end-use applications that work here in Minnesota. So it was very Minnesota-centric. There was a high-level analysis of the technical potential for these applications here in Minnesota and a discussion of the market barriers and opportunities. And given that the barriers and opportunities really are specific state by state, we relied on local stakeholder input to help inform the report. There's a levelized cost of energy analysis completed for the different technologies and a look at international, national best practices for solar heating and cooling technologies. on the policy level. The report concludes with recommendations. There were 10 recommendations in all. But we wanted to cover some of the key findings. We all know that solar thermal is technically feasible statewide. Every community has a solar resource. But what we wanted to answer through this report was, what are the most logical applications for solar thermal in the state in terms of the economics? And there were three standouts, including commercial customers that rely on expensive heating fuels, such as electricity and delivered fuels, agricultural applications, where the load characteristics coincide with solar resource either day by day or season to season, and also with low-income housing, where price volatility for energy is problematic for both owners and residents. A common thread for each of these different sectors is that while the upfront investment is significant, the fuel is free and over the long run reduces risks associated with volatility in pricing and availability. In all three of the cases that we mentioned, the delivered fuels market is one such characteristic that adds the most value in terms of all the different end uses and applications. Depending on the system configuration, solar can also make a structure more resilient in cases when conventional heat fails by reducing the risks of pipes freezing or deferring the need to refill propane or fuel oil. And I had mentioned that the report included 10 recommendations for us to consider. The department has already taken efforts to address the fifth one, which deals with soft costs. And the department was fortunate to get a grant from the Department of Energy Sunshot Initiative, in which we could take a look at the soft costs related to solar, such as those we see in the permitting area. And we have tools available for local governments to utilize if they're interested in streamlining the permitting process for their constituents or reducing the need for things like structural engineering. Here are the last of the recommendations, just for you to glance at. Another of the recommendations that we will be considering internally would be to create a solar heating and cooling advisory group. The report recommended that we do this for the purpose of metering standards and certifications, but it might be beneficial to expand that focus of the group as well. So in conclusion, I think it's important to realize that the solar heating and cooling market is nowhere nearly advanced as the solar PV market. In fact, it's probably 10 years or more behind PV for electricity end uses, just as PV might be 10 years behind wind. So while there are similarities, I guess there are a lot of differences in terms of market development. And also, it's a high-value technology option here in Minnesota. It works perfectly well, but it is underutilized due to market barriers, and those include the initial cost. Solar is still expensive. It also includes the fact that for those consumers that might be interested in solar, they may not have the opportunities to participate in some of our standard programs as, say, an investor-owned utility customer might. And the last takeaway would be that solar thermal can mitigate the expense of heating with electricity and certainly the volatility associated with pricing and availability of delivered fuels. In the case of solar hot water, we might expect that in Minnesota a family could heat half or more of their hot water needs through solar thermal. And in the case of space heating, if we use a direct air-to-air system, we might be looking at 30% offset. So that concludes my presentation.
Thank you. I know there's at least one company who sells this on a regular basis to residential customers, is it? The one I was familiar with. Are they also selling to industrial customers? You mentioned commercial customers using expensive heating oil. Are there Minnesota solar thermal companies that are selling, that are hitting these niches right now? I only am aware of one company. I was just curious if there are a number of them out there.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. The state actually is unique in that we have four OEMs that operate here manufacturing solar collectors. So they do serve everything from, say, a typical two-collector residential system for heating hot water to bigger industrial systems for space heating and industrial process heat, water heating.
And people, customers buying these are, I mean, if you're a propane user right now, obviously this might be a good time to have had one, but the cost of them, everybody says, is very high, and I was just curious, is the price of this falling the way photovoltaic systems are falling? Is there a cost curve that's the same way on this? Is this going to be a big segment of the future or not, I guess, is part of the question.
Sure. Well, Mr. Chair, the price declines that we've seen in PV, particularly for the modules and somewhat for the labor, are not being realized in the solar heating and cooling sector. Some of that has to do with materials. Some of it has to do with the labor intensity of these systems as compared to PV. A typical two-collector residential system might cost $10,000 today, as it did perhaps, you know, 5 years ago. So.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Are there other places in this country that are further along in advancing solar thermal adoption, the residential or commercial level?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, yes. We see market growth certainly in the warmer climates. While it's feasible here, I guess it's all the more feasible in Arizona, where, say, you only need one collector as opposed to two, and the risk of freezing is a bit reduced. Florida is a hot market. We see it for pool heating. That's another use. California. So it is, and oh, yes, Hawaii. Hawaii, indeed. It is up and coming in other states.
So,
Senator Dibble, with that.
So, Mr. Chair, so are the costs coming down in those places with wider adoption of the technology?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I am not familiar with the cost curves there in other states.
I'll be curious if the department or anyone has a sense of some things, technologies keep coming down fast, and I don't know if this one is one that has potential to come down. Obviously, the examples of where you suggest it might have the best potential are the most expensive, the places that have the most expensive sources of heating fuels and so on right now. And okay, so we'll be watching for more information in the future. Representative Earhart had a question as well, I believe.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was asked the other day about community-based something or other for residences. And how does that work?
Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, I think you were probably hearing about community solar gardens, and XL Energy is a proposal in front of the Public Utilities Commission right now as a result of legislation that you passed last year. That is a PV, a solar electric option, whereby residents pool their resources to develop one system, and they are subscribers then to that system. And once XL's program is approved by the commission, we will be seeing those kinds of projects springing up, certainly around XL service territory.
Well, Mr. Chairman, is that a neighborhood group that gets together, and where do they build their solar things, on the roofs then or something or other?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Earhart, actually, yes, it could be a neighborhood group. In order to be a subscriber to a solar garden, you need to be at least in a contiguous county to where the system is constructed. I think you're going to see these springing up, as soon as XL's proposal is approved.
Thank you.
Sure.
Senator Dibble.
Sorry, just one last question. I'm wondering, again, this is about other places, the report recommendations. Are other places, do other places have some of these incentives, working on the codes or the permitted streamlining or some financing options or community outreach efforts? Do we have examples from other places where these kinds of things are working well?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, yes. I think generally some of these recommendations have been taken from other states. For example, Oregon and maybe other states have attempted to bring down the costs associated with solar thermal by having a bulk purchase sort of opportunity for their residents. This was done in Portland with both PV and solar thermal. And I believe Hawaii has a solar readiness requirement now as part of statute, so that any new construction must be built as solar ready, which makes the cost of implementing solar much more affordable once that decision is made to do so.
And Mr. Chair, so. And the delivered fuel industry is hedging and diversifying in those other states. Just kidding. I'd be curious to know how to engage the delivered fuel providers in this subject.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble. Interestingly, this report with the recommendations came out well before we were aware, and the authors were aware of how serious the propane crisis was. So I realize that delivered fuels comes up three times in their recommendations, but it's just.
Just amazingly prescient with why.
Well, just if I could add, I know Jason Edens and the R Real company operates as a nonprofit up in northern Minnesota, and that they have, through the weatherization program, I believe, installed solar thermal at homes that were getting propane. So it'd be interesting to hear from some of the homeowners or renters where Jason Edens has installed his solar thermal, and how they're faring this winter compared to some of their neighbors with the propane. But my understanding is we can use the weatherization dollars to do that, just like we could use the weatherization dollars to, tighten up the windows or whatever. So I think maybe we should be doing more of that.
Senator Osmek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your recommendation number 2, it says implement solar-ready building standards. Can you more clearly define what, if we did go in that direction, what we would anticipate for an average home or an average business that would have to comply with said business standards to be solar ready? What type of increase would they expect in their build-out costs to comply with that type of a standard?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Senator Osmek, this could entail anything from dictating the orientation of the structure to simply building chases through which conduit can be run, for piping, wiring, things like that. So the cost is said to be very minimal, and certainly under 5%, and I believe actually much less than that, maybe on the order of 1% or less. And it depends, too, on how far you take it. The solar readiness factor. But it's simple things like considering space for a future solar storage tank, a hot water storage tank for a solar system that would go in later, and the mechanical room, so that you don't have to retrofit or find a less than optimal way to install the storage tank.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. Appreciate the presentation, and I would be interested if some of the customers who had put these in propane heating things, what their experience was.
Mr. Chairman, we'll gather that data and get it to the committee.
If you can find some. Mm-hmm. We have one more quick report. I know we were trying to finish by 5. We also have one on the energy storage, on-site energy storage that the legislature asked for. Mr. Trudeau, welcome to the commission. And I think this is going to be fairly brief. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Lisa Trudeau with the department for the last 8 years, and I'm here to provide a brief summary of the electric energy storage report required by 2013 legislation. The report was submitted on January 1st and was completed by Stratagem Consulting for the department with analytical support provided by the Electric Power Research Institute on modeling and a financial analysis. The report investigates the potential costs and benefits of on-site utility-managed electrical energy storage in Minnesota at residential and commercial buildings. The scope of work, as identified in legislation, was to perform a cost-benefit analysis, potential value of on-site energy storage devices, including interaction with solar photovoltaic devices, and to analyze barriers and recommendations to overcome those barriers to installing energy storage projects. The contractor used four main use case scenarios to model the costs and benefits of energy storage. First use case was customer controlled for offsetting peak demand charges and offsetting energy charges for time of use customers. The second use case was utility controlled for providing distribution system energy quality benefits and for improving customer reliability and power quality. And then the third use case scenario was a combination of use case two plus transmission grid operator market participation. So MISO market participation to provide frequency regulation and additional grid services. Use case four was a hybrid of one and three, so prioritizing on-site customer needs for offsetting peak energy use, but then providing grid services during those times when energy storage capacity wasn't being used. The key findings were that use case three provided the highest benefit to cost ratio due to the ability to capture multiple value streams. And the range in values are due to variations in the individual scenarios for different rate structures and the interaction with PV. The value streams captured in use case three that were modeled are deferral of distribution upgrade costs, reduced wear and tear on peaking power plants, gas combustion turbines, and additional financial incentives by combining energy storage with electrical solar photovoltaic incentives. Stratagem's key conclusions were that this, as a preliminary short-term study, identified potential benefits from case three to utilities and ratepayers from energy storage projects, and identified three main key barriers, and in that first, customers are generally unable to monetize all of the value streams provided by energy storage projects due to existing rate structures. The utility planning process does not currently account for storage value to offset peaker plant ramping up and down. And the role of energy storage in MISO to provide value to the energy storage owners is still somewhat unclear. Stratagem's key recommendations are that further study and pilot projects should be performed in Minnesota to provide greater confidence for financing further energy storage projects and for allowing utility planning for energy storage projects, and to clarify the role of energy storage in state policy and to establish goals to fit Minnesota needs. And that concludes my presentation.
Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On slide five, you identify in your key findings the cost-benefit ratios. And just so I understand, the red line in the grid, that is break-even. That is, for every dollar that we put in, we received a identifiable amount of savings of a dollar. So it was a break-even scenario. So in cases one, two, and four in your study, the costs put in were greater than the actual benefit that was achieved. Is that, am I reading this correctly?
That's correct. The net present value over the project lifetime did not, the benefits did not exceed the costs for those other scenarios. I should note that this was an initial preliminary study with a short period of time available to do the analysis and a short period of time to collect data needed to perform a more in-depth study of costs and benefits. So it may not have analyzed every value stream, and it may not have captured full customer variability that would provide greater benefit to cost ratios from energy storage.
And in your case number three, Mr. Chairman, in a follow-up on this, so case number three, you may, or according to what I'm seeing here, you may or may not have, based on your range, you may or may not have some level of savings on that particular ratio either. And if you did, it is incredibly minimal considering the dollar impact, correct?
At this point, due to competitive energy rates in Minnesota and current rate structures, the range does it is modest at this point.
Okay, thank you.
And Ms. Trudeau, with right now, I mean, I think a lot of customers that would have on-site energy storage would be those who are disconnected from the grid because obviously they need it then. In terms of ones where your people on the grid, obviously, as Sir Osmek pointed out, only one of the four has any chance of breaking even now. I think we're all watching what's going on with energy storage technology and so on, and there has not been a big breakthrough. There are lots of little things happening. Have you looked at what other studies have done in terms of big picture when some of these things may cross the line, if they're going to cross the line? And that was beyond the scope of this study, I know, but in preparing for it, did you take a look at what people are talking about in terms of that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The report does cover, it provides an overview of energy storage technologies generally. This modeling looked specifically at three battery storage types. It did not consider, for example, electric vehicle battery storage. It didn't consider secondary markets from electric vehicle batteries. And so the scope was fairly limited in that sense. The report, though, is very useful in that it provides an overview of energy storage technologies, grid services, and it does include an overview of electric to thermal storage as well.
And this was put out at beginning of January. When did you complete this, sir?
January 1st.
Okay, it is available. I haven't looked at it yet. You can tell, but yes, I appreciate it. Thank you. Further questions? If not, thank you very much for the presentation. And if there's no further business, we don't have a next meeting scheduled. It'll be perhaps one during session, I think.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to apologize for letting that swear word slip there when I was talking, but I think there's something to be said about the regulatory process on that pipeline. And I don't know whose fault that is, but apparently it's not adequate. And it must be federal, and I think that is a key component in what has happened here.
Your point is well taken. I think the federal government was, the pipeline owners were arguing that they'd make more money doing the other fuels, but I think the reliability of the delivery to customers who need it is a big point, too. We will be hearing a lot more on that issue, I'm sure, both from the department and the administration and our constituents, I think, in the coming weeks and months. So,
Chair?
Senator Senjum,
maybe
yes.
Just a comment. Our executive director routinely sends out little news items. I don't know if she covered this one or not, but Dairyland Power is going to be building a 2-acre, 517-watt or kilowatt solar farm or park, I guess, just north of Rochester. Made a decision very recently. It'll be there for highway viewing, and so it will cause some conversation.
That's good. Did you say that the executive director sent that out, or you haven't?
No, I don't know if she did.
If you make sure she has it, I think we'll all see it then. So thank you. If there's no further business, the commission is adjourned.